I could start off by saying he's a fighter and he's a survivor, but he's a whole lot more than just that. I don't want to just put a label on him, put him in a box, because you'll find out in a minute. We went to see Charlie Daniels in the pouring ass rain. We had to bail after about three songs, but we had backstage passes, and we got there before the security guards did. So we sat down in the little lounge there and made ourselves a home, like, you know, we belong there. So Charlie Daniels comes in, he's signing pictures, and Craig starts talking about people that he and Charlie Daniels know, and he's like, "Oh my God, I hadn't heard that name in 30 years. So Craig is connected in the music industry, and I'm just glad to call him my friend. Yeah. With that, I give you Craig.
Well, hello, everybody. I'm a Craig Williams, and it's cool to be sober.
Hey, Craig.
I tell you, it didn't used to be, but it is today. I have to be truthful with you right from the very start. There's nothing good in me. I'm a horse thief, I'm a liar, and I'm a cheat. I'm selfish, I'm dishonest, I'm self-centered, I'm self-seeking, and the worst part about it is that I know it. And the best part about it is that I can say it and get rid of it. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the gift of vision. I can see where I went astray. I can see where I was right, where I was wrong, and when I didn't care at all. But I'm kind of getting ahead of myself. I want to stop and just reflect for a minute on this time of year, because it was 10 days ago I celebrated a 38-year anniversary with my wife, Rita, that never would have happened if I hadn't gotten sober. And if I live to Monday, and if the creek don't dry, I'll have 33 years sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's right. All you math majors out there, you already figured it out. Yeah, she saw my demise for 5 years before I got into the program. And I remember one day she said, "Look, you're going to die. You're killing yourself, and I don't want to stick around and watch it anymore. And if you don't do something about it, I'm leaving." Well, I'd heard this story before. I'm leaving. This is like the epitaph, the 38th time or the 50th or something. She ain't leaving. But something told me that she just might. This time she just might mean it. So I opened my eyes a little bit, and I remembered I did a couple things I'll tell you about later. When I married Rita 38 years ago on May 27th, I said, "Okay, we'll go to Elko, Nevada and get married. We're living in Salt Lake City." I met this Missouri blonde in Salt Lake City, surrounded by all the Mormons, and neither one of us were a Mormon. It was an interesting lifestyle there. Beautiful people, beautiful spot, kind of a hectic mentality. But I said, "Okay, we'll go to Elko. We'll get married." Now, I haven't ever asked a woman to marry me. It's been kind of like this understanding that we come to after a while. I didn't ask my first wife to marry her. She told me she had a dream that she was going to marry me. And I kind of like let that play out after a while, because nobody had ever been that serious about me before. And it was just the thing she was going through. It was a 3 or 4 year thing, I'm pretty sure, but we got married. I divorced her exactly 1 year after we were married, and moved down to Salt Lake City where I met Rita. But we're driving across Salt Lake Desert, I've got my cooler full of beer. I've got my pre-rolled joints, and I'm kind of like telling her that she didn't exactly hit the lottery today. You know, this isn't going to be the best thing that's ever happened to you, and I'm letting you know right now. So we get to Elko, and she says, well, maybe we better not do this. And I said, wait a minute. I didn't drive all the way over across the desert and up over the mountains for this not to go down. So with that, I will begin at the beginning of the story. Needless to say, we got married. And all the way back, we were shaking our heads trying to figure out what we were going to do next. But that's what I was always doing until I got here. I think my untreated alcoholism started in kindergarten. If you stay sober long enough, God will take you back to as far back as you want. But he took me back to many beginnings. But it was in kindergarten that he focused my attention on my behavior. I had never heard of show and tell before. It was a new phenomenon. I watched these kids parade up there and talk about going shopping with mom, going fishing with dad. I wasn't allowed to do any of that stuff. So I went up there and told them I had a goat in the backyard and it was a secret. We lived in Detroit. Not exactly the suburbs either. So I got a lot of nah, you don't got a goat. He's lying. There's no goat. I stood firm. I had a goat, and it was going to be in the backyard, and it was a secret. And they believed me. For 2 months, I had it going. And then there was another phenomenon I had never heard of, teacher-parent meeting. And my teacher didn't really bust me. She just happened to mention on their way out, well, how's the goat? How's Craig's goat doing? They said, excuse me? And they went back and sat down again. Well, I was a little anxious because I knew that they were meeting with my kindergarten teacher. And when they came home, it was, oh, Craig! Craig, where are you? Well, that was when I started to learn how to hide from my parents because they told me that a goat had to go. But they were merciful about it. We gave it to a lonely farmer out in the country, and it was gone. And I had to go in to show and tell everybody that I gave the goat away. Oh, no, man, you didn't give the goat away. Had to do it. Untreated alcoholism. I was a flaming asshole right from Jump Street. But I had a story to tell. You know, everybody has a story to tell. You want to stand up there and tell your story. Today, all day, I've been saying, what am I doing? Why do I want to go up there and tell my story? I get nervous. I get excited. What am I going to say? How is it going to come out? You know, you go through all the human properties that we do when we do a dialogue. But I finally decided, oh, what the hell. I know everybody here anyway, and they know me. So it's cool. Then I found out about women. I had three sisters, so they weren't new to me. But I didn't know what they were capable of. I had an older sister who was older. I had one 2 years younger than me who was different, and my baby sister hadn't arrived yet because that didn't happen for a few more years. But I came home one day after kindergarten and had been playing with my friend Joey, and I'm walking down the sidewalk to the house, and Jill met me halfway home and said, somebody took a nickel out of mom's purse and bought a Good Humor ice cream. Do you know anything about it? And I said, well, how do you know they bought a Good Humor ice cream with the nickel? And she says, Dad says we're not going to go to the lake today if somebody doesn't fess up. So I took a beating for that one because I wanted to go to the lake. And I realized how I had been manipulated. She was going to go to the lake too. She just wasn't going to get beat for it. And then my dad said, "I'm so goddamn mad, we aren't going to the lake now." And I said, "Well, I got to tell you the truth, I didn't take the nickel." So we had that kind of interaction with the family. Probably dysfunctional as they come. Alcohol hadn't really been introduced to us. My dad was teaching at Wayne State at the time, his first tenure, or his first semester. And gradually, within a couple of years, we moved to East Lansing, Michigan, and he started out at Michigan State, where he would consequently retire as head of the history department years later. My dad was a producer. He was a shaker and a baker, and we all had it in us. But once Dad got started, we were kind of like little shadows, and we were to be looked upon and not heard from. And that's difficult when you're just like Dad. So I gradually found out that I had to play a role around taking care of the family when I was home, and being an independent kid playing with the boys whenever I got a chance to do it. I don't know really when I started fearing my dad. I think that it was because every time he came home, I got whipped. But I couldn't figure out how he knew I had done half the stuff I had done, because he hadn't been there to see it. And I always loved my mom, and I figured that she was safe. But the problem was, Mom was telling Dad the stuff, and I hadn't figured that out yet. I was a slow learner on that curve, because all Dad wanted to do was to come home, have dinner, go to bed with Mom, and get up and go back to school. I started thinking I was foreplay. Come home, beat Craig, eat, go to bed. Anyway, after a while, I went to high school, played a little bit of sports, kept getting hurt, ruptured my quadriceps, running track. And I had been pointing for my senior year basketball team because they were good. I was a steady Eddie fifth man, but they were good. And I knew that a long time before my senior year. And I could hardly play. I'm running up and down the court once in a while with the leg cast on, almost wrapped down to my ankles, trying to participate. I'd get a few minutes here and there. But, I had a surgery where they cut me from my knee up to my groin my junior year in high school. Well, my senior year in high school, it was in November, and I was back on the team playing in January. This is 1966. They didn't have arthroscopic surgeries. They just went in and cut you. And I was labored with that for a long time. I had to have another surgery as soon as I got out of high school. That's when they put the nylon mesh in. So I was one Y, never had to go into the military. So I decided I was getting out of the basketball racket, and I was finally going to do what I wanted to do, buy a set of drums. But Dad would never buy me a set of drums, and I didn't have any money. But I met this kid when I was in going to the pre-registration at Michigan State. He was a good-looking blonde guy, played rhythm guitar. I figured he'd look good standing up there. And first day at Hubbard Hall, this brand-new dorm at Michigan State, 1966, it was a 12-story dorm. I went down to a music store with a couple of guys that I had just met with their dad. They said, "Hey, you want to go to the Bible Lab?" So I go along for lunch, and there was a music store there. I walked in the music store, there was a kid playing a guitar. I said, "If I buy those drums, do you want to start a band?" He says, "Yeah, sure, I got a bass player." I said, "Cool, I got a rhythm guitar player." And then I said, "But how do I buy the drums?" And the dad says, "Do you need a co-signer?" I walked out of there with the drums. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. So we go back to the dorm. I call everybody. They come over that night. We go downstairs and set everything up. Our first rehearsal, well, there was no school had started yet. It was 5 days before school started. there's 100 kids downstairs dancing to our first rehearsal. That's when I realized, well, if everything else goes to hell, I can always do this. Because it works. Of course, we weren't great. We were playing Gloria last time. Hanky Panky. Tommy James and Shonda. Anything that we could possibly think up on the spot, because we were playing a show, man. Boom, just like that. So that's kind of how I got started in the music business. And then we started playing everywhere. Fraternities, sororities, the young adult dance downtown. And I started realizing that I was the booking agent, because if we were going to do anything, these guys didn't know how to do it. I was always the leader of this stuff. And then when I got tired of it, I was the quitter of this kind of stuff. And I always left everybody in the dust. And they resented it. I remember being really surprised when somebody called me a fucker. You quit us! And I said, what do you mean? What do you mean? I just went down to Florida with a friend, you know, for a month. What are you talking about? You quit school and you went down there and you quit the band, you quit everything. I would do stuff like that. Untreated alcoholism. I would just go for no reason whatsoever. So anyway, I come back and my dad wasn't real happy. Of course, I had flipped for the first term anyway. He wasn't out any money. But made things pretty rough at home because that was the only place I had to go. So I enlisted in the military. And I went into the Army, 4-year hitch in the Army Security Agency. Well, I thought I was going to be James Bond. I was just another grunt with a security clearance. And then I get to Fort Dubbins, and my school had already started. It was like a 32-week school, and I wasn't going to be able to start for 30 weeks because it had started 2 weeks ago. So I'm pulling all these details, guard duty, KP, whatever they want me to do. And we used to go into Boston Commons on the weekends, and that's when I really started hitting the alcohol. That's when the booze came into my life. And they were doing this thing called marijuana on the hill, too. And they were passing around joints. First time I ever smoked pot, we got busted. Guy was having a party on Beacon Hill. We were there. Come to find out he had a new girlfriend. The old boyfriend didn't like that idea. He called the cops, said, I think they're smoking pot over there. So there's like 18 of us in this little tiny place. I'm like, knock, 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 police. Everybody screams, runs. There was a closet. Honestly, the guy opened up the door, and I walked in. I closed the door. I'm listening to all this stuff out here. How many of you are here? Okay, what's going on? Blah, 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 blah. Then I hear, how many of you military guys are in here? Because they had checked somebody's ID. I went, oh, no. And he said, 3. And then I decided to walk out of the closet and let him know that I was one of the guys. I said, yeah, I'm in the military, too. And he got mad, and he told us, hit the bricks. Get out of here. So that's what happened my first time I smoked pot. I highly recommend not doing what I did. Don't go into the closet and hide from it. Face the music. If you're going to do the crime, you got to do the time. That's what I learned from that one. So what happens is that I slip on KP, they find out about my leg, and next thing I know, in front of this captain, and he's saying, Williams, what are you doing in this man's army? And I went, Fort Wayne said it was okay. And then he told me that he could either do a third surgery or I could go home and go back to school. Only this time, I didn't know 6 months and you're a veteran. And I'm being honest with you. He just charged me 7 months, 12 days. That's how long I was in the military, and I'm classified as a veteran. So I went back to school, met a girl. A couple of years later, it was like decision time. Do I do music? Do I get married? Music, married. I play music. It really broke my heart, too, because I loved her. But I didn't want to not be able to play. And that led to more drinking. See, she was straighter than I was. She didn't drink. And she didn't smoke, and she didn't do any of the stuff that I did. So that didn't work out very well. And the next thing I know, we're playing with the circuit around mid-Michigan, and we're with different guys, different bands, and I get to know all these guys. And one guy was a hell of a salesman, and I didn't know it. He was the bass player and buddy in a different band. And he told me about this gig in New York called Dallas Arbor at the time, and they had Hammond drums and guitars, Sound City amplifiers. They had Mellotrons. They had everything that the bands were using at that time, and they needed a guy in the drum to run the drum company. And next thing I know, I'm in New York. Next thing I know, I'm living in a 36-room mansion with three other people. The sales manager and his wife and me and my buddy that went out there with me. And all we did was party 24/7. Sales manager had convinced this guy that we needed to look real impressive to all these people we were selling stuff to. And he did a very convincing job. For 1 year we lived in that place because he had signed a lease and couldn't get out of it. So my experience in the music business really started to grow then, because I was out promoting the drums, trying to get bands to play the music. And I ran with a lot of good groups that I didn't even know were good. I came into the warehouse one day and there were four guys hanging outside. Now, these guys were alcoholics. It was rainy. It was cold. They had all the long hair that I had, but longer. And they were all garfed up. And I get out of the car, and I'm the first one there, and the first guy says, "Hey, mate, are you with Dallas Abita?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "We're with a band called Genesis, and we just lost our Mellotron off the trolley in Boston, and we got a show tonight. Can you help us out?" And I didn't know who they were. I said, "Well, probably." I said, "We'll have to talk to the boss, but come on in, get some coffee." And that night I met all that band, and I had like 20 backstage passes, and all my friends were there, and they all said, "Yeah, these guys are pretty good. Yeah, we like these guys." So, but everything was just starting then. This is 1973-74. But there was also an energy crunch going on at the time. If you had lived back then, you would know that from you could only get gas on even days if your driver's license was a 2. And if it was a 1, you could only get it on odd days. So, like, they had it all set up, 1, 2, 3, 4. And they had lines waiting in New Jersey to get gas. And they also had the same situation manufacturing in England. And that's where the drums came from. And they closed the line down. So I am selling off everything. I got like 5 good promoting drummers. One quick story. I went into the warehouse with Barry Lazarowitz. He was playing with Janis Eaton at the time. They had a song out called 17. And we were doing a photo shoot at the warehouse, had the biggest everything set up. And there was this old man wandering around the warehouse. And I said to Barry, "Just about be right back." I go up to this guy, I said, "Can I help you, sir?" He says, "No, I'm just browsing around here." And we had big bins, and they went like this fall, and they had amps on them, and they had guitars underneath them or whatever. And he was crawling around this, and I said to Barry, "I'll be right back." And I go in the office, I said, "There's some crazy old man wandering around the warehouse." And they started laughing. So that's Les Paul. I said, "You're kidding me." So I got, I said, "Barry, come here." I walked up the guy. I said, "I think we got off on the wrong foot." I said, "You're Les Paul?" And he said, "Yeah." So I introduced myself, and Barry says, "Oh, well, you guys play." He says, "You want to come over to my house?" I said, "Where do you live?" He lived like within a mile. Yeah, Mahwah, New Jersey, that's where our warehouse was. So we said, "Yeah," as soon as we're done with the shoot. So we do that. Then everybody wanted to go over to Les's house with us, which was okay. So there's a caravan going over to Les Paul's studio to see it. It was crazy. But those are the kinds of things that were happening to me all the time. But after the drums went dead, I went dead. I went back to Michigan and kind of like did an Eric Clapton, hid in my house for like 2 years and just like drank myself down dirty. Wasn't having a good time. Had a lot of friends that had a lot of dope. They liked me. They'd come over and they'd party with me all the time. And I wasn't getting any better until I finally decided that I'd crawl out of my cocoon and go back to school again. And that's when I met my first wife, Lisa. And that lasted 4 years, like I said, and then I met Rita out in Salt Lake. I was selling wine when I was going to Michigan State. I was doing wine tastings individually. Go to your place, business, or your home, or wherever you wanted to drink it, and pour it for you. And you would buy it by the case. And the stuff was good. The German wines, if you like white wines, you had the Qualitätswein and then the Mitpredikats that were a little bit later grapes. You know, you pick them the first 10 days of October, and that was the quality wine. And then the Cabernet wine, which is what the Wittner kept for his own cabinet. I know all of you people know all of this about wine. That was the next 10-day picks. And then the Spät, late harvest was like, and it went on and on. Well, at first, you know, I would, like, do a wine tasting, tell them that it came from the Mosel or the Rhine or the Ra or whatever river it was on. Romance the shit out of it, hold up the label, say, this is the birth certificate of the wine. Now listen, you know, this is when it was born, 76, okay? And this is where it came from, this is city, Peace Porter, it's just Peace Porter, you're from New York, you know, and I had it all down. And then I would wait till I got to the most expensive wine. I go, oh, no, this one's good. I like this one, you know, and I'd drink it with them. Well, that's how I sold the most expensive wines, because if the wine man liked it, everybody liked it. Well, that lasted about a month and a half, and then I just started right in with them. This is a quality wine. You're going to like it, guys. Yeah, I kind of like the whole smoothness of it disappeared, and the buzz was on. I was after optimum buzzability. I have a PhD in substance abuse. So that lasted a while, and then they wanted to open up Denver, and I wanted to move to Colorado because Lisa's dad was senior vice president of Western Grocers, and he wanted her out there. And I said, yeah, okay, that's fine. Then the company moved me to Denver, and that's how I ended up in Denver. And then she got a job with a food brokerage company, and she had nothing to do out there for like 6 months while I was selling wine. And then her dad got her job with the food brokerage company. She got a credit card and a car, and she was gone. And I don't blame her, because I was a drunk by then. Absolutely, I was a drunk. I hated her for it, because I didn't think she should have done it. But I hated myself even more because I made her do it. So that was a miserable time until I got hired by another company to go and open up a 5-state distribution ring in the West. We're headquartered in Salt Lake City, and we're going to do Wyoming, Idaho, Nevada, whatever. And I hired this guy, and he says, oh, I got a girl for you. Her name's Linda. You're going to love her. And then this other guy who I took out to Utah with me said, he said, I got a girl for you too, her name's Rita. Now, I knew my buddy was married, and, you know, so I figured I'd have the pick of the two. And so we go, and Linda was like, she and I were sparks. Just, the minute I saw her, I knew she didn't like me, because I didn't like her either. But Rita was just really nice. She, you know, I could just tell she had a nice heart, hidden under all that good stuff. So we ended up getting together, and I told you about how we ended up married. I took her back to Michigan to introduce her to my family. What a mistake. Last thing my sisters wanted was competition, and the last thing my mom and dad wanted was me back. But I had made him suffer for 5 more years until I finally got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I told you how that happened. You're killing yourself, and I don't want to watch it anymore. Now, it's interesting, there was this young fellow by the name of Denny who had started working at the furniture store with us. And Denny was a quiet guy, and he had been around for maybe a month. He was always kept to himself, while the rest of us are like a bunch of crazies smoking in this little 5-by-10 room and answering phone calls and trying to sell furniture and bullshit each other all the time. And one Saturday morning, Denny walked in and he looked at us and says, "Boy, I sure am glad I don't feel like the way you guys have looked today." And off he walked. And I'm like, "What the fuck?" I heard him. And I bumped into him about 2 hours later. He was running one way, I was running another. And I go, "Hey, Denny!" I said, "What did you mean by what you said over there about, you know, glad you don't feel like we look?" I said, "Did you used to drink?" I asked the guy, I said, "Did you used to drink?" He says, "Yeah." I said, "Well, what made you stop drinking?" He said, "When I realized I couldn't have just one." Mm-hmm. I thought, what a sucker. No wonder. If I couldn't handle my booze better than that, I'd quit too. Right? I mean, I can handle more than one. I can handle a bunch of this stuff. But anyway, it got me thinking. And on Tuesday, I went to my first AA meeting. That was June 7th, 1988, at the Presbyterian Mount Hope Church. We call it a Mount Hope Church because on Mount Hope Road, it was a Presbyterian church. But I was the second person there at 8 o'clock, about 7:45 in the morning. I never got up at 8 o'clock in the morning to go anywhere. I would be like the guy that dragged his ass into work at 10:05, waiting for the first person to point out I was late. Here I am early. And I look at this guy, and nobody else is coming in. I'm thinking, we're the only two drunks in town? And then they started coming in behind me. And then these two guys looked at me, and they disappeared, and they come back, and one guy gives me a big book, and the other one gives me a 24-hour Hazelton book. Welcome. Well, what do you mean, welcome? What's going on here? Nobody gives me anything. Books? I got to read this? So that's how I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that first meeting, I saw this little guy. He was about this tall. He was working construction in Grand Rapids. Well, that's where the wine company was. We used to have to go to Grand Rapids from Lansing, pitch, set up wine tastings Monday and Tuesday, and come back Tuesday night and stay over Monday night. That was always a great fiasco. Nobody was in any mood to do anything on Tuesday, let me tell you. But he said that he would have to go to Grand Rapids and work, and then they would all drink while he came back, and he wasn't drinking anymore. Well, I drank myself back from Grand Rapids to Lansing all the time. And I knew that route, and I knew what he was talking about. And then somebody right after him mentioned God, and it was like a light bulb. Because I had been an altar boy, you know, long, 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 long time ago. And I went, oh, that's how they do it. God. Oh, my God, God. Yeah, it scared me. Because if there really was a God, I was in some serious doo-doo. So I decided that maybe you people really had something here. And then a little while later, this big guy named Jim, he goes, "I had 6 months today." And I went, 6 months, okay, now let's see. If I could stay sober for 6 months, and I felt like that would be a big payoff. And if I didn't, I would have only wasted 6 months. I could drink again. Or whatever I wanted to. And that's just the way my mind worked. I was always looking for the easier, softer way. So I end up sticking around. And I haven't had a drink since. And it's incredible. You think about that. I walked into that situation, that screwed up, and haven't had a drink since. Now, there were a couple of guys. I had Denny at work. Denny used to say, if you see me standing against the wall and I got my hand in my pocket, I'm daydreaming. I said, stop right there. He says, no, really. I've got my coin in my hand. I'm praying. I said, okay. And he meant it, and I understood that. And I realized that you could pray at work. and that you could pray anywhere you wanted to. First time I got down on my knees about the third night after my first meeting, and I was so embarrassed. I couldn't even remember a prayer. Then I remembered that they said the Our Father at the meeting. I went, okay, and I started saying Our Father. I started to cry because it had been so long, and I felt naked. I actually saw God hitting one of his angels and saying, look at Williams. Can you believe this shit? I saw that. I had a vision of that. I felt that low. But I kept praying because they told me fake it until you make it. And that's what I did. And then 2 months later, just like the big book says, I packed up and moved to California. Because Rita went out ahead of me because she had a job opportunity. We tried to decide whether to go to Phoenix or Sacramento. It was going to be Phoenix. This last minute she says, where do you want to go? I said, let's go to Sacramento. She said, okay. Because she could go either place. So she went out and got things set up. And then I didn't tell you that I inherited an 11 and a 9-year-old boy and girl with Rita. I was a shitty father. It wasn't fun. I remember when I made my amends to Suzanne, before I left town, I told her that I was sorry, blah, blah, blah. She says, Craig, I always thought you were a cool guy, except when you were drinking from the mouth of babes. Yeah. She was getting ready to start her freshman year at Michigan State. I just got through moving her from one apartment to another. Hell, I didn't even have a house till I was over 40. I was an apartment guy or a over at your house guy or anybody got a room guy. Yeah. That's the way I lived my life for 4 years. So, anyway, I was driving out to California. I was pulling a load, big load. It said, don't pull more than 900 miles. I didn't read it until I got to Sacramento. It said, don't pull anything more than 900 pounds behind this car. Well, just the thing itself weighed 900 pounds. And I had it packed with everything I owned, which wasn't a lot, but it was everything she owned. So I'm all the way across the country. I got the foot pedal about 55 miles. That's as fast as I could go. So I'm finally up in the foothills of Nevada, close to Elko, which is crazy. And a voice said to me, take your foot off the gas. And as I came up over this little rise, it started to come down. I took my foot off the gas and I actually listened to that voice. And the car went vroom and it took off and started gun picking up at 60. I'm looking at it, 65. 70. My eyes are getting bigger. I'm getting freaked out. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm thinking I'm about the only guy on the road. And then I see these three trucks going up the side of this mountain like this. I come zooming around, I'm going up, and I'm passing these trucks. I'm going, God, you are God. There's no, I'm just like totally convinced. And a voice says to me, if me, why not my son? Totally blew me away. I was not ready for that. I was not ready for that. But I heard it loud and clear. It takes what it takes for an individual to discover what is available to them in this world. I have found that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me back so much more than I have given to it. A room full of people like you here trying to stay sober one day at a time, given me some time so that I can tell you what happened to me. Yeah, nobody used to want to listen to me. I didn't have anything to say. I was that horse thief. I was that self-centered guy. I was the guy that you were all talking about in my head, and it wouldn't leave me alone. I was paranoid or superstitious, whatever you wanted to call it. I could reach heights of the unknown with my ability to get confused. But in AA, it's so simple. All you have to do is put a plug in a jug, stop doing everything else that's killing you, and do the steps. And I have found that the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are everything that I need to get me high. I started doing prison meetings in California. I had 6 months sober. There was this little Latino guy. His name was Tino. Oh, I hated Tino. He always stood up and talked about how he was abusing her as a kid and cried. I could say, come on, Tino, we've heard this story 500 times. But I wasn't Tino, and I didn't know how bad it hurt him. I wasn't that experienced enough yet. I didn't have a heart yet. You know, hearts come slowly. Knowledge drifts in gradually. You slowly start to understand the language of the heart in here. And he said, you want to go to the prison meeting? You got 6 months now. You want to go to prison meeting? I went, no. I don't want to go in a fucking prison. He says, well, we're going to Vacaville Tuesday night. You want to go? I said, no, I just told you I didn't want to go. He says, well, Lena's going, and Tom's going, and Bill's going, and Bob's going. Don't you want to go? And then I was like, well, damn, if everybody's going and I'm not. Yeah, okay, I'll go. So I go to prison meeting. I ended up doing service work at Vacaville and Folsom prisons for 5 years. First 5 years of my sobriety, I was in those prisons at least three times a month. And that's the real deal in there. I saw prisoners trying to get out of prison using Alcoholics Anonymous. There was this one guy, he killed three people. He was convinced he was going to get out through AA. Mm-hmm. He was convinced. You've seen it. I remember hearing a guy's fourth and fifth step in a closet off the meeting room at Folsom. And I went and picked him up the day he got out, and I drove him to Lodi from Sacramento. I took him to a meeting, and I said, here you go, man. You're on your own. But don't drink. And I left him there. 6 months later, the guy's back in the slammer because he cannot stop drinking. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, people out there think Alcoholics Anonymous is for people to stop drinking. That's not true. It's for people who can't stop drinking. There's a difference. If you can't stop drinking, Alcoholics Anonymous is for you. I've learned a lot in this program. I've learned things that I never thought existed. And I've come to care about people in a way that I didn't think that I always felt like I was the outsider. I didn't know how to care about anybody. I didn't know how to love. And I didn't know how to be loved. I was just always awkward in both those categories. But a gradual renaissance started happening in me. Character defects are something that will always be with us. It just depends upon how much power we give to them. You know, we are our thoughts, and if we want to concentrate on being lustful, brother, you're going to be lustful. Can't help it. That's a character defect. If you want to spend your time thinking about how you can be useful, sister, you're going to be useful. Because that's what you're putting all your power into. And that's what I found here today. In Alcoholics Anonymous, I have found that the steps lead to a green pasture of delight and the cool water fulfillment. And pleasure and enlightenment is the way of the journey. If you want to make it work, that's all you have to do. And those are some pretty big promises. I got to tell you, I was at Walmart this morning getting some supplies, and I walk out, and I'm thinking about talking tonight, and what am I going to say? And I don't want to get into a drunk log because everybody there knows what it takes to get here. Yeah, you don't need me standing up here telling you about that. And I'm listening to the music that's blasting out of some speakers somewhere. And it's going, promises, promises. Promises, promises. Some old song from a long time ago. I barely remember it, but I remembered the hook. And I just started laughing. Isn't it the truth? The promises of Alcoholics Anonymous, so we don't have to drink anymore. That we can heal, that we can grow, that we can be of use to our brothers and sisters. We can help each other through the calamity of life. I mean, I've faced some calamities in life. And I know that everybody here has. You know, I'm not special. I'm not exceptional. I'm just ordinary Joe, as our Chris at the Brown Baggers always says, just a garden variety drunk. And we remember all our brothers and sisters and the things that they said and they did if we attend meetings, if we do the steps, and if we work with others. Now, I got to tell you a story. One more. I have my stepdaughter, Suzanne, is now 50. And she was up in North Carolina before Christmas. And she was talking to her mom. And they were at some kind of an antique store. Big barn had all kinds of stuff in it. And there was a picture of this goat, aluminum-made goat. And Rita saw it, started laughing, and told this story about my kindergarten experience. So at Christmas time, this great big box is underneath the tree. I opened it up, and there's this goat. And the first thing I said is, "I'm not a liar anymore." With great pride. I named the goat Wilson. Wilson the goat, after Bill. And I have several sponsees who have come to me since then. And we are now the Goat Brothers. The greatest of all time. And I want to thank you all for being here tonight. Give me an opportunity to let off some steam and tell you a little bit about what I've done, where I've been, and how I didn't handle it all that well. So God bless you all. I love you. Thank you very much.